KALW.
Scientists were wrong about what kind of earthquake it was. It was big, but it didn't make the ocean floor move up and down, which is what causes tsunamis.
What are you going to do the next time you get an emergency alert on your phone?
If they'd waited to make absolutely sure it was a tsunami, people would have had less time to evacuate.
What we learned from last week's tsunami warning. Then we hear how the dirt around us holds lots of secrets.
Luster and color. Geology is a very sensual thing.
The surprisingly seductive geological saga in Oakland.
You can also nibble on sedimentary rocks. That tells you the composition of the sediment.
It's a new episode of Book It. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Last week, Bay Area residents received quite the shock when phones all over the region lit up with a tsunami evacuation warning. One emergency alert from the National Weather Service read, "You are in danger. Get away from the coastal waters, move to high ground or inland now." An earthquake that hit 45 miles off the coast of Humboldt County sparked the warning. And the earthquake was big, 7 on the Richter scale, and scientists were worried. But after about an hour, the warning was canceled. People were relieved, but they had questions about what just happened. To get some answers, I sat down with KALW emergency and disaster preparedness reporter Ren Farrell. Hey, Ren.
Hi, Hannah.
So you were in San Francisco when the tsunami warning went out. What was that like for you?
I live on the top floor of my building, and I'm far from all the hazard zones, so I wasn't really worried.
Mm-hmm.
But my downstairs neighbor texted me, kind of panicked, and asked if she could come up to my apartment.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people were panicking. But then less than an hour later, they canceled the warning. Why was that?
Scientists were wrong about what kind of earthquake it was. It was big, but it didn't make the ocean floor move up and down, which is what causes tsunamis.
So then, is it fair to call it a false alarm?
I mean, in a way, yes, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have issued it.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd waited to make absolutely sure it was a tsunami, people would have had less time to evacuate. And time is so critical in natural disasters.
Okay, so I was here in Union City in my car with my daughter, and we got the alerts, and we were totally freaked out. Nothing really happened. We didn't feel anything. We weren't near the water. But you were in San Francisco. So how were folks reacting in the city?
It was really a mixed bag. You know, some people like my neighbor were taking it really seriously and went as high up as they could. But then there were the people who weren't taking it so seriously. There were quote unquote tsunami watchers hanging out at Ocean Beach and in other parts of SF.
Is that like tornado chasers in the Midwest?
Yeah, I mean, there's such an irony to the word tsunami watcher because it's like, well, if you can see a tsunami, that means you're probably about to die.
I mean, yeah.
For some reason, there's this idea that a tsunami couldn't actually hit the Bay Area that hard, which is just patently untrue. Since 1850, there have been more than 50 tsunamis recorded or observed in the San Francisco Bay. And just because we haven't had a catastrophic one hit in recent memory doesn't mean it's not possible.
Okay. So how did the city respond?
BART really quickly shut down the Transbay Tube because of the earthquake. The San Francisco Department of Emergency Management shared the tsunami alert from the National Weather Service with residents via Alert SF and a few other methods like social media. The San Francisco Zoo evacuated guests, quote unquote, secured the animals and closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And the city sent first responders to Ocean Beach and other vulnerable areas where they were telling people to move at least a block away from the ocean.
Okay.
Later, people were wondering why they didn't hear sirens or anything more dramatic, which brought renewed attention to the fact that the city's emergency siren system has been down for years. They closed it in 2019 for repairs, but then the pandemic happened and money got allocated to other emergency services, and the Department of Emergency Management just hasn't been able to secure the necessary funding to turn the sirens back on.
Hmm. So that's the city. How about the East Bay? What did officials do there?
Oakland officials were monitoring the situation, but didn't issue evacuation orders. Berkeley, on the other hand, immediately activated their emergency operations center, which streamlines and centralizes communications. Mm-hmm. So they sent out an alert on Alameda County Alerts, or AC Alerts.
Yep, we got them.
And then they were also posting on social media and using their outdoor warning system, which was telling people to evacuate.
Yeah.
And then they also sent first responders to evacuate the waterfront and even had Highway Patrol closing down certain off-ramps on I-80.
Mm. In terms of these evacuations, where were people evacuated to?
So there wasn't a centralized evacuation destination, and that's true in San Francisco and Oakland as well. And I actually spoke to a West Berkeley resident, his name's Walker Dovin, who told me that he really appreciates how seriously Berkeley took the situation, but that he wishes there had been designated evacuation destinations because he felt confused and scared about what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a tense situation. Do you know how many people were impacted?
There were over 5 million people under the tsunami warning at one point.
5 million people, that's a lot. So what advice would you have for them knowing all of this that just happened?
The first piece of advice I have for people is to sign up for their local emergency alert systems. You know, I think a lot of people got the alert, but there were people who didn't get the alert. We're going to post more information about how to sign up for relevant emergency alerts on our website.
I have to say, getting all of those alerts, it was kind of confusing. It was a lot. Folks are already scared and overwhelmed. Honestly, we did not know what to do. We are not near the water. So it's like, well, what do I do? You're sending me these alerts, but only certain neighborhoods were actually threatened. It felt like it was a mess. Do you think this could have been handled differently?
I think it's always better to be safe than sorry when it comes to natural disasters. And so, yes, even though it was scary, it's good that they got the information out to as many people as possible. And, you know, the way that I think about this is that we were actually super lucky because this was an amazing test run of our natural disaster preparedness.
Mm.
Hopefully this is going to motivate more people to just get informed about everything that they need to get informed about, evacuation routes, to sign up for emergency alerts. And, you know, hopefully it will also help governments hone their emergency preparedness procedures.
Right.
Berkeley right now is actually actively seeking feedback on how it handled the situation. I also think that the renewed attention on San Francisco's emergency siren system is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just a few days after the tsunami warning, the Bay Area was under an air quality alert. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, yep.
To me, that was just another reminder that we don't know what the next major natural disaster is going to be. It could be a tsunami. It could be a fire. It could be an earthquake.
Yay.
We're certainly overdue for the next big one.
Gosh.
I just think the best thing people can do to protect themselves and their loved ones is to get informed and be prepared. Build a go bag, create a plan with loved ones, and tell your friends to do the same.
Okay, so a go bag. I definitely need one of those. So, Ren, remind us, what do you put in a go bag?
You are not alone in needing a go bag. I think most people don't have go bags. Everybody's go bag, quote unquote, is going to look a little different depending on what you and your family's needs are. But you're definitely going to want at least a 3-day supply of non-perishable food and water, a battery-powered or hand crank radio, backup batteries, a flashlight, a first aid kit, and whatever prescription medications you absolutely can't live without.
Mm.
The list can really go on, and, you know, there are go bags, and then there are home kits, which can be even larger. We're going to post a more thorough checklist about go bags and home kits on our website.
Great, and that is KALW.org. Thanks, Ren.
Thanks, Anna.
Ren is KALW's emergency and disaster preparedness reporter. You can hear more of his work and find all the resources Ren was talking about at KALW.org/crosscurrents. Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Next, we'll stay thinking about the Earth, and we'll be digging into the dirt in Oakland with a segment from Book It, a look at Bay Area books and authors with host Angie Coiro. This time, she brings us a love letter to the geology of Oakland.
That's really what this week's book is, Hannah. It's Deep Oakland, How Geology Shaped a City. And my guest is geologist Andrew Alden. The book's out in hardcover now, and come spring, it will be joined on the shelves by its paperback version. Andrew's review of Oakland's landscape, rocks, and soil is wrapped in wonderful stories that can only come from loving your subject. We started out with a bit of a quirky tidbit, why you might find geologists licking and nibbling rocks.
There are a few rocks that you can taste, yes. You taste them, see if they absorb liquid. If your tongue sticks to them, then you know that you've got such and such. You can also nibble on sedimentary rocks. That tells you the composition of the sediment, whether it's pure clay. Pure clay is chewy and smooth, like chocolate. But if it has a little grit in it, then you know you have silt. That's why you chew very carefully. But yeah, geologists, we teach that in geology school. And then finally, if you can taste salt, that tells you something too.
And it's a matter of how the light reflects too, is that right?
Oh, luster and color, you know, geology is a very sensual thing, whether you're looking at soil or rocks.
Turning a geologist's eyes is kind of like snorkeling, it says. This is some of your own verbiage, which is beautiful. The surface world with all its sound and motion drops away, and the entire different world swims into view. That's a beautiful way to describe it. Tell me what that is like to suddenly be immersed in the landscape and in the soil.
It's hard to say because I've been doing it for so long. It's just natural. But a geologist walks around the landscape, and where we see trees and vegetation and roads and cars, they ignore all that. You know, you screen it all out, and you look at the contours of the land. You look at what you can see in the vista and the distance, and you look for signs of the underground, whether it's a stream valley and a road cut with some rocks exposed. That's stuff you look for. Those are your clues. And you ignore everything else, and that's a new way for people to see.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one of the more pleasant things. You can see its mark on the soil and the land, and you start with it in the book, the Hayward Fault. Mm. When you say mentioning the Hayward Fault can feel a bit indecent, what in the world do you mean?
Well, whenever you're walking along the fault, and this has happened to me more than once, you go in front of someone's house and you're looking at cracks in the roadway, you're looking at curbs that are offset because the sides of the two sides are moving sideways and ripping apart everything that's built on top of them.
Ooh, yeah.
And homeowners will come out and say, "Hi, what you doing?" And you're going, "Well, I'm looking at something that would make you uneasy."
Yes.
Every talk I give, and I give talks, and they're all benign, but the earthquake always comes up. So
yeah,
we all know about it, but we don't want to be here when it happens. We're all rolling the dice that it won't happen while we're alive, while our mortgage is running, you know, whatever.
Well, and the Hayward Fault, there's so much right on top of. We're talking about hospitals. We're talking about critical infrastructure. It's not something that's going to happen off to the side. There's also no telling, as is true with all earthquakes, there's no telling when it's going to happen.
There is no telling. There is no telling. We don't say the next big one is overdue. That's the O word. We don't use that word because something that's overdue is behind schedule. Mm. Earthquakes are not scheduled. They are basically random. And that's as much as I want to say. You know, the frontiers of seismology, they're finding hints of order here and there. There's nothing they can take to the bank, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's something, since you are a poetic soul, you could almost say there's some kind of romanticism in that unpredictability.
It's a California thing, you know, California thing. We've Mark Twain lived through the 1865 earthquake, and he gave it his usual Mark Twain treatment. Oh, well, the ground is moving. Well, okay, let's go have a drink, you know. That's what he did. And he was that same way when he went out to the mining district. And, you know, that maybe he picked it up in California because it's an old attitude. And the Spanish had it. And the Ohlones had it, too. All the native tribes had it because they have long memories. And they knew where the earth would break and what would happen. Now, it didn't hurt them very much. A tree might fall on you, you know. A big earthquake will disturb the ground, that the streams will start flowing differently. And they knew that, and they lived a very earthquake-resistant lifestyle by necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew, and the Spanish knew, because the very first expedition into Alta California in 1769, they hit one of LA's largest earthquakes. Is one of the biggest ever. So they knew right from the start. And in 1812, one of their missions was destroyed. The San Juan Capistrano, I think, in 1812. So they knew. But when the 49ers came rushing in, they just, you know, nothing much had happened up in the Bay Area since 1838. And so to them, you know, a generation later, it was just old stories that the Mexicans told, and you could pretty much ignore it. They worried more about San Francisco burning down, which it did every other year, you know. But then the earthquake started happening. The early Anglo period between, you know, 1850 and 1906, there were 12 major, magnitude 6 earthquakes in the Bay Area. And since 1906, there have been like two.
That's weird.
There was 89, and there was the one in Napa in 2014. So even the Americans knew. In 1906, we had good building practices. In San Francisco in 1906, the downtown buildings survived pretty well. And then the fire came.
Mm-hmm.
And they just couldn't deal with fire. And that's still a big, big worry. With the Hayward Fault earthquake, the next Hayward Fault earthquake, as you say, the city grew over the fault before they really knew it was there. Before they knew it, it was a creeping fault, a fault that actually moves, the surface part moves a few millimeters a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything you build on it gets gradually wrenched apart, whether it's a water line, you know, electric lines, a freeway. They're gradually crumbling. We didn't know that till the 60s. So the whole East Bay is in a very precarious place. The experts who look at the disaster specialists say that Hayward Fault earthquake is probably the most expensive upcoming earthquake.
Mm. You know, you mentioned that it creeps, and you said in the book that creeping are the rarer ones. Why is that? Why don't they all creep? You'd think that with the motion going on.
They're still working on that.
Hmm.
They're still working on that. The theory is that they are not being held together by friction very hard, so that the upper part near the surface where friction is especially weak allows the sides to move apart. Now, down deep where friction is stronger, they're still stuck together. They're still building up energy as the Earth's tectonic plates move inexorably. You know, down deep, down below the crust and the mantle, the upper mantle, the plates are moving very smoothly. And yet at the surface, they crack in a brittle way, in a random fashion. So between that smooth motion and that random brittleness, that's the mystery at the heart of seismology and why it's such an interesting science. It really pushes the boundaries of our mathematical techniques, for instance. It's a very interesting field to get into, and it matters.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to move on from the Hayward Fault. We're going to go to Lake Merritt. And again, your book is divided sectionally. You go to this part of town, that part of town. Lake Merritt is not a lake. Who knew? What is it?
Well, we knew. Lake Merritt has never been a lake. It's an arm of the bay. It's an estuary. But what makes it feel like a lake is that it's unique in the East Bay. There's nothing like it. When the Spanish explorers were coming up the East Bay, they thought, oh, the East Bay looks like a nice flat plain. We can just walk our way up the bay shore. And they ended up staring at this arm of the bay, and they had to walk a league and a half around it, which annoyed them very much with the ups and downs. And I'm going, yeah, that's the way it still is around Lake Merritt. But when I looked into it more deeply, I found a whole story. It took me half the book to tell all pieces of it.
Mm-hmm. You described something about Lake Merritt that's, I'm guessing, is one of the biggest challenges for a geologist. It's been monkeyed around with all its life. You know, people keep trying to rein it in or move it over there or whatever. And let's talk about how, as a geologist, your job is to figure out what has been and what has become with something that's been toyed with to that extent.
Yeah, one of the challenges of doing urban geology is that, you know, you see a rock in a stream bed, well, you look at it, and it's probably a chunk of concrete. You know, it may be an old brick. It may be landfill that someone dumped in it, you know. And so you have to be very wary when you're poking around the city. And that's been fun. I've enjoyed that. But in the case of Lake Merritt, it was originally a slough, a sort of dead-end estuary, a mud flat that ends in a bunch of marsh and maybe some streams flowing into it. And that's what the Ohlones knew it as. They had their village up at the head of Lake Merritt. They could take their little reed boats out onto it and at high tide. When the Americans came, they said, what's this mud flat? Can't we do something different with it? They dredged it out. They built walls around the outside, and they turned it into a lovely urban park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonder, and I love it. You have to love it. You have to love Lake Merritt.
Well, yeah.
It's the heart, the natural heart of Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And I live near it, and I go there all the time, and I wouldn't want to change it, but it keeps changing itself. You know, sea level is rising, and it's already at king tides. It's starting to wash over the sides here and there. So I'm going, because geologists don't really live in the present. We live in the deep present, which is something around 10,000 years, give or take, you know, in the past and the future. And I'm thinking, well, sea level's going to rise. We're going to have to remake the lake. And we have choices to make, mm-hmm. we and our children. And so I wanted, one of the things I wanted to do in deep Oakland was to bring that larger awareness into wider circulation. I want that to be part of our daily conversation. I want that to be what our city councilors and planning departments and people think about in the long term.
That was Angie Coiro with our featured series, Book It. Her guest, Andrew Alden, talked about his book, Deep Oakland, How Geology Shaped a City. There's much more to their conversation. You can hear it all at klw.org/bookit. Tune in Monday morning at 11. Sonoma's helicopter rescue unit is one of the busiest in the country.
We like to keep the amount of time that somebody is hanging on the bottom of that helicopter to as minimum a time as possible.
A special story from our friends at Nocturne, Monday morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Eliza Peppel, Jan Ramirez, Clara Camunde, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, True Gwynn, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shirina Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
This is KALW My mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
My mixtape.
My mixtape.
My mixtape is
one song.
I got a song.
My name is Kimberly Acebo Artecha, and my mixtape is from CNC Music Factory. Everybody dance now. When I was younger, I really loved dancing to this song. I was taking a dance class, and they had a day where you could dress up for Halloween and solo your own choreography, and that was the song that I had picked. It was the first song that I had on cassette tape, and it's one of those songs that no matter what I'm feeling, it'll always pick me up.
The gong, back with the bass, pajamas live in effect, and I don't waste time. On the mic with a dope rhyme, jump to the rhythm, jump, jump to the rhythm, jump. And I'm here to combine beats and lyrics to make you shake your pants, take a chance. Come on and dance, guys, grab a girl, don't wait, make a twirl. It's your world and I'm just a squirrel, trying to get a nut to move your butt to the dance floor. So yo, what's up? Hands in the air, come on, say yeah. Everybody over here, everybody over there. The crowd is live and I will fool this fool. Party people in the house, move.